Operational Designator 15-8-82-666. Operational approval expected today via channels discussed in our meeting. Report when proper contacts established. And that meant that Operation 666 was going forward. The day before, that notice had chilled Zaitsev. But not today. Today he knew he'd be doing something to prevent it. If anything bad happened now, it would be the fault of the Americans. That made a considerable difference. Now he just had to figure how to establish some sort of regular contact with them. Upstairs, Andropov had the foreign minister in his office. "So, Andrei, how do we go about this? Ordinarily our ambassador would meet with their first secretary, but in the interests of security, we might want to try another method of approach." "How much executive authority does their first secretary have?" the chairman asked. "About as much as Koba did 30 years ago. Bulgaria is run in a very tight way. Their Politburo members represent various constituencies, but only their party first secretary really has decision-making power." "Ah, that was good news to Yuri Vladimirovich." He lifted his desk phone. "Send in Colonel Rozhdestvensky," he told his secretary. The colonel appeared through the dresser door in 2 minutes.
"Yes, Comrade Chairman."
"Andrei, this is Colonel Rozhdestvensky, my executive assistant. Colonel, does our Sofia resident talk directly to the Bulgarian head of government?"
"Rarely, comrade, but he has done so occasionally in the past."
Rozhdestvensky was surprised that the chairman didn't know that, but he was still learning how field operations worked. At least he had the good sense to ask questions, and he was not embarrassed to do so. "Very well. For security reasons, we would prefer that the entire Bulgarian Politburo not know the scope of this Operation 666. So, do you think we could have Colonel Bobovoy brief in their party chief and get approval by a more direct route?"
"To that end, a signed letter from Comrade Brezhnev would probably be necessary," Rozhdestvensky answered.
"Yes, that would be the best way to do it," the foreign minister agreed at once.
"A good thought, Colonel," he added approvingly.
"Very well. We'll get that today. Leonid Ilyich will be in his office, Andrei?"
"Yes, Yuri. I will call ahead and tell him what is needed. I can have it drafted in my office if you wish, or would you prefer it to be done here?"
"With your permission, Andrei," Andropov said graciously. "Better that we should do it. And we'll have it couriered to Sofia for delivery tomorrow or the day after."
"Better to give our Bulgarian comrade a few days, Yuri. They are our allies, but they remain a sovereign country after all."
"Quite so, Andrei. Every country in the world had a bureaucracy whose entire purpose was to delay important things from happening.
And we don't want the world to know that our resident is making a highly important call on the man," the foreign minister added, teaching the KGB chairman a little lesson in operational security, Colonel Rozhdestvensky noted.
"How long after that?" Alexei Nikolaevich Andropov asked his aide.
"Several weeks at least."
He saw annoyance in his boss's eyes and decided to explain.
"Comrade Chairman, selecting the right assassin will not be a matter of lifting a phone and dialing a number. Strokov will necessarily be careful in making his selection. People are not as predictable as machines, after all, and this is the most important and most sensitive aspect of the operation."
"Yes, I suppose that is so, Alexei."
"Very well. Notify Bobovoy that a hand-delivered message is on the way." Now, Comrade Chairman, or after we have it signed and ready for the dispatch?
Rozh Destvensky asked the question like a skilled bureaucrat, letting his boss know the best way without saying it out loud.
This colonel would go far, the foreign minister thought, taking note of his name for the first time.
A good point, Colonel.
Very well. I will let you know when the letter is ready to go. By your command, Comrade Chairman. Do you need me further?
No, that is all for now, Andropov answered, sending him on his way.
Yuri Vladimirovich, you have a good aide.
Yes, there is so much for me still to learn here, Andropov admitted, and he educates me every day.
You are fortunate in having so many expert people.
That is the truth, Andrei Andreevich. That is the truth.
Down the hall in his office, Rozh Destvensky drew up the brief dispatch for Bubovoy.
This was moving fast, he thought, but not fast enough for the chairman of the KGB. He really wanted that priest dead. The Politburo certainly seemed fearful of political earthquakes, but Rozh Destvensky himself was doubtful of that. The Pope, after all, was just one person, but the colonel had tailored his advice to what his boss wanted to hear, like a good functionary, while also letting the chairman know the things he needed to know. His job actually carried great power with it. Rozh Destvensky knew that he could break the careers of officers whom he did not like and influence operations to a significant degree. If CIA ever tried to recruit him, he could be an agent of great value. But Colonel Rozh Destvensky was a patriot. And besides, the Americans probably had no idea who he was and what he did. The CIA was more feared than it deserved to be. The Americans didn't really have a feel for espionage. The English did, but KGB and its antecedents had enjoyed some success at infiltrating it in the past. Less so today, unfortunately. The young Cambridge communists of the 1930s were all old now, either in British prisons or drawing their government pensions in peace, or living out their years in Moscow, like Kim Philby, considered a drunk even by Muscovites. He probably drank because he missed his country, missed the place in which he'd grown up, the food and drink and football games, the newspapers with which he'd always philosophically disagree, but he'd miss them even so. What a terrible thing it must be to be a defector, Rozh Destvensky thought.
Zaitsev asked himself, what will I ask for?
Money? CIA probably paid its spies very well. More money than he would ever be able to spend. Luxuries beyond his imagination. A videotape machine. They were just becoming available in Russia, mainly made in Hungary, patterned after Western machines. The bigger problem was in getting tapes. Pornographic ones were particularly in demand. Some of his KGB co-workers spoke of such things. Zaitsev had never seen one himself, but he was curious, as any man might be. The Soviet Union was run by such conservative men. Maybe the Politburo members were just too old to enjoy sex, and so saw no need for younger citizens to indulge. He shook his head. Enough! He had to decide what to tell the American in the metro. That was a task that he chewed on with his lunch in the KGB cafeteria.
Chapter 15. Meeting Place.
Mary Pat was expected to come into the embassy sometimes, to see her husband about family matters or to purchase special food items from the commissary. To do this, she always dressed up. Better than she did for the Moscow streets, with her hair well brushed and held in place by a youthful headband, and her makeup done, so that when she drove into the compound parking lot, she would look like a typical airheaded American blonde. She smiled to herself. She liked being a natural blonde, and anything that made her appear dumb worked for her cover. So she breezed in the front door, waving airily at the ever-polite Marines, and into the elevator. She found her husband alone in his office.
"Hey, baby."
Ed rose to kiss her, then drew back to take in the whole picture.
"Looking good."
"Well, it's an effective disguise." It had worked fine in Iran, too, especially when she'd been pregnant. That country didn't treat women especially well, but it did extend them an odd deference, especially when pregnant, she'd found, right before she'd skipped the country for good. It was one station she didn't particularly miss.
"Yeah, babe. Just gotta get you a surfboard and a nice beach. Maybe the Banzai Pipeline."
"Oh, Ed, that's just so tubular. And Banzai Beach is in Hawaii, dummy." A quick gear change. The flag go up wrong.
"Yep. The TV cameras didn't show anyone on the street paying particular attention to it. But you could see it from a block away, and the security cameras don't look that far out. We'll see if our friend drops a message in my pocket on the ride home tonight."
"What did the Marines say?" she asked.
"They asked why, but Dom didn't tell them anything. Hell, he doesn't know either, does he?"
"He's a good spook, Dominic is," Mary Pat judged.
"Ritter likes him."
"Oh," Foley remembered. He fished a message out of his drawer and handed it across.
"Shit,"
his wife breathed, scanning it quickly.
"The Pope? Those motherfuckers want to kill the Pope?"
Mary Pat didn't always talk like a California blonde.
"Well, there's no information to suggest that directly, but if they want to, we're supposed to find out."
"Sounds like a job for Woodcutter, who was their man in the party secretariat."
"Or maybe Cardinal," Ed wondered.
"We haven't flagged him yet," MP pointed out, "but it would soon be time to check in with him." They checked his apartment every night for the light and blinds combination in his living room. His apartment was agreeably close to their own, and the rat line was well established, beginning with a piece of paper tape on a lamppost. Setting that flag signal was MP's job. She'd already walked Little Eddie by it half a dozen times.
"Is this a job for him?" she asked.
"The president wants to know," her husband pointed out.
"Yeah."
But Cardinal was their most important agent in place, and not one to be alerted unless it was really critical. Cardinal would also know to get something like this out on his own if he became aware of it.
"I'd hold off on that unless Ritter says different."
"Agreed," Ed Foley conceded. If Mary Pat advised caution, then caution was justified. After all, she was the one who enjoyed taking risks and betting her skill against the house odds. But that didn't mean that his wife was a reckless player, either.
"I'll sit on that one for a while."
"Be nice to see what your new contact will do next."
"Bet you cute little tushy, babe."
"Want to meet the ambassador?"
"I suppose it's time," she agreed.
"So, recover from yesterday?" Ryan asked Harding. It was the first time he'd beaten his workmate into the office.
"Yes, I suppose I have."
"If it makes you feel any better, I haven't met the president yet myself, and I'm not exactly looking forward to the experience. Like Mark Twain said about the guy who got himself tarred and feathered, if it weren't for the honor of the thing, he would just as soon have missed it."
Harding managed a brief laugh.
"Precisely, Jack. One does go a little weak in the knees."
"Is she as tough as they say?"
"I'm not sure I'd want to play rugger against her. She's also very, very bright. Doesn't miss a thing, and asks bloody good questions."
"Well, answering them is what they pay us for, Simon," Ryan pointed out. There was no sense being afraid of people who were only doing their job as well, and who needed good information to do it properly.
And her too, Jack. She has to do questions in Parliament.
On this sort of thing? Jack asked, surprised. No, not this. It's occasionally discussed with the opposition, but under strict rules.
You worry about leaks? Jack asked, wondering. In America, there were select committees whose members were thoroughly briefed on what they could say and what they could not. The agency did worry about leaks. They were politicians, after all, but he'd never heard of a serious one off the Hill. Those more often came from inside the agency, and mainly from the seventh floor, or from the White House's West Wing. That didn't mean that CIA was comfortable with leaks of any kind, but at least these were more often than not sanctioned, and often they were disinformation with a political purpose behind them. It was probably the same here, especially since the local news media operated under controls that would have given the New York Times a serious conniption fit.
One always wonders about them, Jack.
So, anything new come in last night?
Nothing new on the Pope, Ryan reported. Our sources, such as they are, have run into a brick wall.
Will you be turning your field spooks loose?
Yes, the PM made it clear to Basil that she wants more information. If something happens to His Holiness, well, she blows a head gasket, right?
You Americans do have a way with words, Jack.
And your president? He'll be seriously pissed. And by that I do not mean hitting the booze. His dad was Catholic, and his mom raised him a Protestant, but he wouldn't be real happy if the Pope so much as catches a late summer cold.
You know, even if we turn some information, it is not at all certain that we'll be able to do a thing with it.
I kind of figured that, but at least we can say something to his protective detail. We can do that much, and maybe he can change his schedule.
No, he won't. He'd rather take the bullet like a man.
But maybe we can interfere somehow with what the bad guys are planning. You just can't know until you have a few facts to rub together.
But that's not really our job, is it?
Harding shook his head as he stirred his morning tea.
No, the field officers feed it to us, and we try to determine what it means.
Frustrating? Ryan wondered. Harding had been at the job much longer than he had.
Frequently. I know the field officers sweat blood doing their jobs, and it can be physically dangerous to the ones who do not have a legal cover. But we users of information can't always see it from their perspective. As a result, they do not appreciate us as much as we appreciate them. I've met with a few of them over the years, and they are good chaps. But it's a clash of cultures, Jack.
Field guys are probably pretty good at analysis themselves when you get down to it, Ryan thought. I wonder how often the analyst community really appreciates that. It was something for Ryan to slip into his mental do-not-forget file. The agency was supposed to be one big happy team after all. Of course it wasn't, even at the seventh floor level.
Anyway, we had this come in from East Germany. Jack handed the folder across. Some rumbles in their political hierarchy last week.
Those bloody Prussians, Harding breathed as he took it and flipped to the first page.
Cheer up. The Russians don't much like them either.
I don't blame them a bit.
Zaitsev was doing some hard thinking at his desk as his brain worked on autopilot. He'd have to meet with his new American friend. There was danger involved unless he could find a nice anonymous place. The good news was that Moscow abounded with such places. The bad news was that the second chief directorate of the KGB probably knew all of them. But if it was crowded enough, that didn't matter.
What would he say? What would he ask for? What would he offer them?
Those were all good questions, weren't they? The dangers would only increase.
The best possible outcome would be for him to leave the Soviet Union permanently with his wife and daughter. Yes, that was what he'd ask for, and if the Americans said no, he'd just melt back into his accustomed reality, knowing that he'd tried. He had things they would want, and he'd make it clear to them that the price of that information was his escape. Life in the West, he thought. All the decadent things the state preached to everyone who could read a newspaper or watch TV. All the awful things they talked about. The way America treated its minorities. They even showed pictures on TV of the slum areas. But they also showed automobiles. If America oppressed its blacks, why then did it allow them to purchase so many automobiles? Why did it permit them to riot in the streets? Had that sort of thing happened in the USSR, the government would have called in armed troops. So no, the state propaganda could not be entirely true, could it? And besides, wasn't he white? What did he care about some discontented blacks who could buy any car they wished? Like most Russians, he'd only seen black people on TV. His first reaction was to wonder if there really were such a thing as a chocolate man, but yes, there were. KGB ran operations in Africa. But then he asked himself, could he remember a KGB operation in America using a black agent? Not very many, perhaps one or two, and those had both been sergeants in the American Army. If blacks were oppressed, how then did they get to become sergeants? In the Red Army, only the politically reliable were admitted to sergeant school. So, one more lie uncovered, and that one only because he worked for KGB. What other lies was he being told? Why not leave? Why not ask the Americans for a ticket out? But will they grant it? Zaitsev wondered. Surely they would. He could tell them about all manner of KGB operations in the West. He had the names of officers and the code names of agents, traitors to the Western governments, people whom they would definitely wish to eliminate. Was that being an accessory to murder? He asked himself. No, it was not. Those persons were traitors, after all. And a traitor was a traitor. And what does that make you, Oleg Ivanovich? The little voice in his mind asked, just to torment him. But he was strong enough now to shake it off with a simple movement of his head left and right. Traitor? No, he was preventing a murder, and that was an honorable thing. And he was an honorable man. But he still had to figure a way to do it. He had to meet with an American spy and say what he wanted. Where and how? It would have to be a crowded place where people could bump into each other so naturally that even a counter-spy from the Second Chief Directorate would not be able to see what was happening or hear what was being said. And suddenly, he realized. His own wife worked in such a place. So he'd write it down on another blank message form and transfer it on the metro, as he'd already done twice. Then he'd see if the Americans really wanted to play his game. He was in the chairman's seat now, wasn't he? He had something they wanted, and he controlled how they could get it, and he would make the rules in this game, and they would have to play by those rules. It was just that simple, wasn't it? Yes, he told himself. Wasn't this wretch? He'd be doing something the KGB had always wanted to do. Dictate terms to the American CIA. Chairman for a day, the communicator told himself. The words had a delicious taste to them. In London, Kathy watched as two local ophthalmic surgeons worked on one Ronald Smithson, a bricklayer with a tumor behind his right eye. The X-rays showed a mass about half the size of a golf ball, which had been so worrisome that Mr. Smithson had only waited 5 weeks for the procedure to be done. That was maybe 33 days longer than it would have been at Hopkins, but considerably faster than was usual over here. The two Moorfields surgeons were Clive Hood and Jeffrey Phillips, both experienced senior residents. It was a fairly routine procedure. After exposing the tumor, a sliver was removed for freezing and dispatched to pathology. They had a good histopathologist on duty, and he would decide if the growth was benign or malignant. Kathy hoped for the former, as the malignant variety of this tumor could be troublesome for its victims. But the odds were heavily on the patient's side, she thought. On visual examination, it didn't look terribly aggressive, and her eye was right about 85% of the time. It was bad science to tell herself that, and she knew it. It was almost superstition, but surgeons like baseball players knew about superstition. That was why they put their socks on the same way every morning. Pantyhose, in her case, because they just fell into a pattern of living. And surgeons were creatures of habit, and they tended to translate those dumb personal habits into the outcome of their procedures. So, with the frozen section off to pathology, it was just a matter of excising the pinkish-gray encapsulated mass. "What time is it, Jeffrey?" Dr. Hood asked.
12:45, Clive," Dr. Phillips reported, checking the wall clock.
"How about we break for lunch, then?"
"Fine with me. I could use something to eat. We'll need to call in another anesthesiologist to keep Mr. Smithson unconscious," their gas passer observed.
"Well, call and get one, Owen, would you?" Hood suggested.
"Righto," Dr. Ellis agreed.
He left his chair at the patient's head and walked to the wall phone. He was back in seconds. 2 minutes.
"Excellent. Where to, Jeffrey?" Hood asked.
"The Frog and Toad. They serve a fine bacon, lettuce, and tomato with chips."
"Splendid," Hood said.
Kathy Ryan, standing behind Dr. Phillips, kept her mouth shut behind the surgical mask, but her china blue eyes had gone wide. They were leaving a patient unconscious on the table while they went to lunch. Who were these guys? Witch doctors? The backup anesthesiologist came in just then, all gowned up and ready to take over.
"Anything I need to know, Owen?" he asked Ellis.
"Entirely routine," the primary gas passer replied. He pointed to the various instruments measuring the patient's vital signs, and they were all in the dead center of normal values, Kathy saw. But even so, Hood led them out to the dressing room, where the four medics shucked their greens and grabbed their coats, then left for the corridor and the steps down to street level. Kathy followed, not knowing what else to do.
"So, Caroline, how do you like London?" Hood asked pleasantly.
"We like it a lot," she answered, still somewhat shell-shocked.
"And your children?"
"Well, we have a very nice nanny, a young lady from South Africa."
"One of our more civilized local customs," Phillips observed approvingly. The pub was scarcely a block away, west on City Road. A table was quickly found. Hood immediately fished out a cigarette and lit it. He noticed Kathy's disapproving look.
"Yes, Mrs. Ryan, I know it's not healthy and bad form for a physician,
But we are all entitled to one human weakness, aren't we?
You're seeking approval from the wrong person, she responded. Ah, well, I'll blow the smoke away from you, then.
Hood had himself a chuckle as the waiter came over. What sort of beer do you have here? He asked him.
It was good that he smoked, Kathy told herself. She had trouble handling more than one major shock at a time, but at least that one gave her fair warning. Hood and Phillips both decided on John Courage. Ellis preferred Tetley's. Kathy opted for a Coca-Cola. The docs mainly talked shop, as physicians often do. For her part, Carolyn Ryan sat back in her wooden chair, observing three physicians enjoying beer, and in one case a smoke, while their blissfully unconscious patient was on nitrous oxide in operating room number 3. So, how do we do things here? Differently from Johns Hopkins? Hood asked as he stubbed out his cigarette. Kathy nearly gagged, but decided not to make any of the comments running around her brain. Well, surgery is surgery. I'm surprised that you don't have very many CAT scans. Same for MRI and PET scanners. How can you do without them? I mean, at home, Mr. Smithson, I wouldn't even think of going in without a good set of shots of the tumor.
She's right, you know, Hood thought, after a moment's reflection. Our bricklayer chum could have waited several months more if we'd had a better idea of the extent of the growth.
You wait that long for hemangioma? Kathy blurted out. At home, we take them out immediately.
She didn't have to add that these things hurt to have inside your skull. It caused a frontal protrusion of the eyeball itself, sometimes with blurring of vision, which was why Mr. Smithson had gone to this local doctor to begin with. He'd also reported god-awful headaches that must have driven him mad until they'd given him a codeine-based analgesic.
Well, here things operate a little differently.
Uh-huh. That must be a good way to practice medicine. By the hour instead of by the patient.
Lunch arrived.
The sandwich was okay. Better than the hospital food she was accustomed to.
But she still couldn't get over these guys drinking beer. The local beer was about double the potency of American stuff, and they were drinking a full pint of it. 16 ounces. What the hell was this?
Ketchup for your chips, Kathy.
Ellis slid the bottle over.
Or should I say, Lady Caroline? I hear that His Highness is your son's godfather.
Well, sort of. He agreed to it. Jack asked him on the spur of the moment in the hospital at the Naval Academy. The real godparents are Robbie and Sissy Jackson. Robbie's a Navy fighter pilot. Sissy plays concert piano.
Was that the black chap in the papers?
That's right. Jack met him when they were both teachers at the Naval Academy, and they're very close friends.
Quite so. So the news reports were correct?
I mean, I try not to think about it. The only good thing that happened that night was that little Jack arrived.
I quite understand that, Kathy, Ellis responded around his sandwich. If the news accounts were accurate, it must have been a horrid evening.
It wasn't fun. She managed a smile. The labor and delivery was the good part.
The three Brits had a good laugh at that remark. All had kids, and all had been there for the deliveries, which were no more fun for British women than for American women. Half an hour later, they headed back to Moorfields.
Hood smoked another cigarette along the way, though he had the good manners to stay downwind of his American colleague. 10 more minutes and they were back in the O.R. The pinch-hitting gas passer reported that nothing untoward had taken place, and surgery resumed. "Want me to assist now?" Kathy asked, hopefully.
"No, thank you, Kathy," Hood replied. "I have it," he added, bending over his patient, who, being soundly asleep, wouldn't smell the beer on his breath.
Carolyn Ryan, M.D., FACS, thought to congratulate herself for not screaming her head off. But mostly she leaned in as closely as she could to make sure these two Englishmen didn't screw up and remove the patient's ear by mistake. Maybe the alcohol would help steady their hands, she told herself. But she had to concentrate to keep her own hands from trembling. The Crown and Cushion was a delightful, if typical, London pub. The sandwich was just fine, and Ryan enjoyed a pint of John Smith ale while talking shop with Simon. He thought vaguely about serving beer at the CIA cafeteria, but that would never fly. Someone in Congress would find out and raise hell in front of the C-SPAN cameras, while enjoying a glass of Chardonnay with his lunch in the Capitol building, of course, or something a little stronger in his office. The culture was just different here, and vive la différence, he thought, walking across Westminster Bridge Road toward Big Ben. The bell, not the bell tower, which was, in fact, St. Mary's bell tower, tourist errors to the contrary. The parliamentarians there had 3 or 4 pubs right there in the building, Ryan was sure, and they probably didn't get any drunker than their American colleagues. You know, Simon, I think everyone's worried about this.
It's a pity he had to send that letter to Warsaw, isn't it?
Could you expect him not to? Ryan countered. They are his people. It is his homeland, after all, isn't it? It's his parish the Russians are trying to stomp on.
That is the problem, Harding agreed. But the Russians will not change. Impasse.
Ryan nodded. Yeah. What's the chance that the Russians will back off? Absent a solid reason to, not a very great chance. Will your president try to warn them off? Even if he could, he wouldn't. Not something like this, buddy. So we have 2 sides. One is driven by what it deems to be the proper moral course of action, and the other by political necessity, by fear of not acting. As I said, Jack, it's a bloody impasse. Father Tim at Georgetown liked to say that wars are begun by frightened men. They're afraid of the consequences of war, but they are more afraid of not fighting. Hell of a way to run a world, Ryan thought out loud, opening the door for his friend. August 1914, as the model, I expect.
Right. But at least those guys all believed in God. The second go-around was a little different in that respect. The players in that one, the bad guys anyway, didn't live under that particular constraint. Neither did the guys in Moscow. You know, there have to be some limits on our actions, or we can turn into monsters.
Tell that to the Politburo, Jack, Harding suggested lightly.
Yeah, Simon. Sure.
Ryan headed off to the men's room to dump some of his liquid lunch. The evening didn't come quickly enough for either of the players. Ed Foley wondered what was coming next. There was no guarantee that this guy would follow up on what he'd started. He could always get cold feet. Actually, it'd be rather a sensible thing for him to do. Treason was dangerous outside the U.S. Embassy. He was still wearing a green tie. The other one. He had only 2. For luck, because he'd gotten to the point where luck counted. Whoever the guy was, just so he didn't get cold feet. Come on, Ivan. Keep coming and we'll give you the joint, Foley thought, trying to reach out with his mind. Lifetime ticket to Disney World, all the football games you can handle.
Oleg Penkovsky wanted to meet Kennedy, and yeah, we can probably swing that with a new president. Hell, we'll even throw in a movie in the White House theater. And across town, Mary Pat was thinking exactly the same thing. If this went one more step, she'd play a part in the opening drama. If this guy worked in the Russian Mercury, and if he wanted a ticket out of Mother Russia, then she and Ed would have to figure a way to make that happen. There were ways, and they'd been used before, but they weren't what you'd call routine. Soviet border security wasn't exactly perfect, but it was pretty tight. Tight enough to make you sweat playing with it, and though she had the sort of demeanor that often worked well while playing serious games, it didn't make you feel comfortable. And so she started kicking some ideas around, just in her head, as she worked around the apartment and little Eddie took his afternoon nap. And the hours crept by, one lengthy second at a time. Ed Foley hadn't sent any messages off to Langley yet. It wasn't time. He had nothing substantive to report, and there was no sense getting Bob Ritter all excited over something that hadn't developed yet. It happened often enough. People made approaches to CIA and then felt a chill inside their shoes and backed away. You couldn't chase after them. More often than not, you didn't even know who they were, and if you did, and if they decided not to play, the sensible thing for the other guy was to report you to KGB. That fingered you as a spook, rendering your value to your country as approximately zero, and covered his ass nicely as a loyal and vigilant Soviet citizen doing his duty to the motherland. People didn't realize that CIA almost never recruited its agents. No, those people came to you. Sometimes cleverly, sometimes not. That left you open to be fooled by a false flag operation. The American FBI was particularly good at that sort of play, and KGB's second chief directorate was known to use the gambit too, just to identify spooks on the embassy staff, which was always something worth doing. If you knew who they were, you could follow them and watch them service their dead drops, and then camp out on the drop site to see who else stopped off there. Then you had your traitor, who could lead you to other traitors, and with luck, you could roll up a whole spy ring, which earned you a gold star. Well, a nice red star in your copybook. Counter-espionage officers could make their whole careers on one such case, both in Russia and in America, and so they worked pretty hard at it. The second directorate people were numerous. Supposedly half of KGB's personnel were in there, and they were smart, professional spooks with all sorts of resources, and the patience of a vulture circling over the Arizona desert, sniffing the air for the smell of a dead jackrabbit, then homing in to feast on the carcass. But KGB was more dangerous than a vulture. A vulture didn't actively hunt. Ed Foley could never be sure if he had a shadow as he traveled around Moscow. Oh, sure, he might spot one, but that could just be a deliberate effort to put a clumsy or an exceedingly clever officer on his tail to see if he'd try to shake him. All intelligence officers were trained in surveillance and counter-surveillance, and the techniques were both universally valid and universally recognized. And so Foley never used them. Not ever. Not even once. It was too dangerous to be clever in this game, because you could never be clever enough. There were other countermoves to use when necessary, like the pre-planned brush pass known to every spook in the world, but very difficult to spot even so, because of its very simplicity. No, when that failed, it was usually because your agent got rattled. It was a lot harder to be an agent than a field officer. Foley had diplomatic cover. The Russians could have movie film of him buggering Andropov's pet goat and not be able to do a thing about it. He was technically a diplomat, and protected by the Vienna Convention, which made his person inviolable. Even in time of war, though things got a little dicier then. But that, Foley judged, was not a problem. He'd be fried like everyone else in Moscow then, and so would not be lonely in whatever afterlife spies inhabited. He wrenched his mind away from the irrelevancies, entertaining though they might be. It came down to one thing. Would his friend Ivan take the next step, or would he just fade back into the woodwork, taking satisfaction that he'd managed to make the U.S. Embassy dance to his tune one cool Moscow morning? To find that out, you had to turn over the cards. Would it be blackjack, or just a pair of fours? That's why you got into this business, Ed, Foley reminded himself. The thrill of the chase. It sure as hell was a thrill, even if the game disappeared into the mists of the forest. It was more fun skinning the bear than smelling it. Why was this guy doing what he was doing? Money, ideology, conscience, ego? Those were the classic reasons, as summarized by the acronym MICE. Some spies just wanted the mayonnaise jar full of $100 bills. Some came to believe in the politics of the foreign countries they served with the religious fervor of the newly converted. Some were troubled because their motherland was doing something they couldn't abide. Some just knew they were better men than their bosses, and this was a way to get even with the sons of bitches. Historically, ideological spies were the most productive. Men would put their lives on the betting line for their beliefs, which was why religious wars were so bloody. Foley preferred the monetarily motivated. They were always rational, and they'd take chances because the bigger the risk, the greater their reward. Ego-driven agents were touchy and troublesome. Revenge was never a pretty motive for doing anything, and those people were usually unstable. Conscience was almost as good as ideology. At least they were driven by a principle of sorts. The truth of the matter was that CIA paid its agents well, just out of the spirit of fair play, if nothing else. And besides, it didn't hurt to have that word out on the street. Knowing that you'd be properly compensated made for one hell of a tiebreaker for those who had trouble making up their minds. Whatever your baseline motivation, being paid was always attractive. The ideological needed to eat, too. So did the conscience-driven. And the ego types saw that living well was indeed a pretty good form of revenge. Which one are you, Ivan? Foley wondered. What is driving you to betray your country? The Russians were a ferociously patriotic people. When Stephen Decatur said, "Our country, right or wrong," he could well have been speaking as a Russian citizen. But the country was so badly run. Tragically so. Russia had to be the world's unluckiest nation. First, too large to be governed efficiently, then taken over by the hopelessly inept Romanovs. And then when even they couldn't hold back the vitality of their nation, dropped screaming into the bloody maw of the First World War, suffering such huge casualties that Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, Lenin, had been able to take over and set in place a political regime calculated to do destruction to itself. Then handing the wounded country over to the most vicious psychopath since Caligula, in the person of Joseph Stalin. The accumulation of that sort of abuse was beginning to shake the faith of the people here. "Your mind sure is wandering, Foley," the chief of station told himself. Another half hour. He'd leave the embassy on time and catch the metro, with his top coat open and loose around him, and just wait and see. He headed off to the men's room. Occasionally, his bladder got as excited as his intellect. Across town, Zaitsev took his time. He'd be able to write on only one message blank. Throwing one away in plain view was too dangerous. The burn bag could not be trusted, and he could hardly light one up in his ashtray. And so he mentally composed his message, then rethought the words, then rethought them again, and again, and again. The process took him more than an hour in full, and then he was able to write it up surreptitiously, fold it, and tuck it into his cigarette pack. Little Eddie slid his favorite Transformers tape into the VCR. Mary Pat watched idly, behind her son's rapt attention on the living room floor. Then it hit her. That's what I am, she realized. I transform myself from ditzy blonde housewife to CIA spy. And I do it seamlessly. The thought appealed to her. She was giving the Soviet bear a peptic ulcer, hopefully a bleeding one that wouldn't be fixed by drinking milk and taking Rolaids. In another 40 minutes, Ed will find out if his new friend really wants to play, and if he wants to play, I'll have to work the agent. I'll hold his hand and lead him along and take his information and send it off to Langley. What will he give us? She wondered. Something nice and juicy? Does he work in their communications center, or does he just have access to a blank message pad? Probably a lot of those in the center. Well, maybe, depending on their security procedures. Those would be pretty stringent. Only a very few people would be trusted with KGB signals. And that was the worm dangling on the hook, she knew, watching a Kenworth diesel tractor turn into a two-legged robot. This Christmas, they'd have to start buying those toys. She wondered if little Eddie would need help transforming them. The time came. Ed would leave the embassy door exactly on time, which would be a comfort to his shadow, if any. If there was, he'd notice a green tie again and think that the earlier one was not all that unusual. Not unusual enough to be any sort of signal for an agent he might be working. Even the KGB couldn't think every embassy employee was a spook, Foley told himself. Despite the paranoia that was pandemic in the Soviet Union, even they knew the rules of the game. And his friend from the New York Times had probably told his own contacts that Foley was a dumb son of a bitch who hadn't even made it as a police reporter in the Big Apple, where the busy police made that field about as difficult as watching TV on a weekend. The best possible cover for a spook was to be too dumb. And what better person to set it up for him than that arrogant ass Anthony? Never just plain Tony, Prince. Out on the street, the air was cool with approaching autumn. Ed wondered if the Russian winter was all it was cracked up to be. If so, you could always dress for cold weather. It was heat that Foley detested, though he remembered playing stickball out on the streets and the sprinklers on the tops of some of the fire hydrants. The innocence of youth was far behind him. A damn far way behind, the chief of station reflected, checking his watch as he entered the metro station. As before, the efficiency of the metro worked for him, and he entered the usual subway car. Zaitsev thought, maneuvering that way. His American friend was doing everything exactly as before, reading his paper, his right hand on the grab rail, his raincoat hanging loose around him. And in a minute or two, he was standing next to him. Foley's peripheral vision was still working. The shape was there, dressed exactly as before. Okay, Ivan, make your transfer. Be careful, boy, be very careful, his mind said, knowing that this sort of thing was going to be too dangerous to sustain. No, they'd have to set up a dead drop somewhere convenient. But first, they'd have to do a meet, and he'd let Mary Pat handle that one for him, probably. She just had a better disguise. Zaitsev waited until the train slowed. Bodies shifted as it did so, and he reached quickly in and out of the offered pocket. Then he turned away, slowly. Not so far as to be obvious, just a natural motion easily explained by the movement of the metro car. Yes! Well done, Ivan! Every fiber of his being wanted to turn and eyeball the guy, but the rules didn't allow that. If there was a shadow in the car, those people noticed that sort of thing, and it wasn't Ed Foley's job to be noticed. so he waited patiently for his subway stop, and this time he turned right, away from Ivan, and made his way off the car, onto the platform, and up to the cool air on the street. He didn't reach into his pocket. Instead, he walked all the way home, as normal as a sunset on a clear day, into the elevator, not reaching in even then, because there could well be a video camera in the ceiling. Not until he got into his flat did Foley pull out the message blank. This time, it was anything but blank, covered with black ink letters, as before, written in English. Whoever Ivan was, Foley reflected, he was educated. And that was very good news, wasn't it? Hi, Ed. A kiss for the microphones. Anything interesting happen at work? The usual crap. What's for dinner? Fish, she answered, looking at the paper in her husband's hand and giving an immediate thumbs up. Bingo, they both thought. They had an agent, a no-shit spy in KGB, working for them. Chapter 16. A Fur Hat for the Winter. They did what? Jack asked. They broke for lunch in the middle of surgery and went to a pub and had a beer each, Kathy replied, repeating herself. Well, so did I. You weren't doing surgery. What would happen if you did that at home? Oh, nothing much, Kathy said. You'd probably lose your license to practice medicine after Bernie amputated your fucking hands with a chainsaw. That got Jack's attention. Kathy didn't talk like that. No shit. I had a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich with chips. That's French fries for us dumb colonials. I had a Coke, by the way. Glad to hear it, doctor. Ryan walked over to give his wife a kiss. She appeared to need it. I've never seen anything like it, she went on. Oh, maybe out in bumfuck Montana they do stuff like that, but not in a real hospital. Kathy, settle down. You're talking like a stevedore. Or maybe a foul-mouthed ex-marine. She finally managed to smile. Jack, I didn't say anything. I didn't know what to say. Those two eye cutters are technically senior to me, but if they ever tried that sort of shit at home, they'd be finished. They wouldn't even let them work on dogs. Is the patient okay? Oh, yeah. The frozen section came back cold as ice. Totally benign, not malignant. And we took out the growth and closed him back up. He'll be just fine. 4 or 5 days for recovery. No impairment to his sight, no more headaches. But those two bozos operated on him with booze in their systems. No harm, no foul, babe, he suggested lamely. Jack, it isn't supposed to be that way. So report them to your friend Bird. I ought to. I really ought to. And what would happen? That lit her up again. I don't know. It's a big deal to take the bread off somebody's table, and you'd be branded as a troublemaker, Jack warned. Jack, at Hopkins, I'd have called them on it right then and there, and there would have been hell to pay. But over here, I'm just a guest. And the customs are different. Not that different. Jack, it's grossly unprofessional. It's potentially harmful to the patient, and that's a line you never cross. At Hopkins, if you have a patient in recovery, or you have surgery the next day, you don't even have a glass of wine with dinner, okay? That's because the good of the patient comes before everything else. Okay, sure, if you're driving home from a party and you see a hurt person on the side of the road and you're the only one around, you do what you can and get him to a doc who's got it all together, and you probably tell that doc that you had a couple before you saw the emergency. I mean, sure, during internship, they work you through impossible hours so you can train yourself to make good decisions when you're not fully functional. but there's always somebody to back you up if you're not capable. And you're supposed to be able to tell when you're in over your head. Okay? I had that happen to me once on pediatric rotation, and it scared the hell out of me when that little kid stopped